to understand war is to understand Satan. Satan is the god of war. And he's not waging war to gain some temporary advantage. He's in it to win. He's in it total war to win. And in total war, peace is not achieved by an armistice where you kind of have a truce. You call off the hostilities. You do not come to terms with Satan. What Satan wants is unconditional surrender because he wants to be the master of all. Now, to try to give an example of war from a battle that at least would be familiar, I would reference the Battle of Stalingrad during World War II. There are about 2 million people in that battle killed or injured, fighting for that city in one specific place. Hitler, in attacking Stalingrad, declared that all the male residents would be killed. He was going to kill every single man in the city, and the women would be deported, which means they would be enslaved. They would be taken into internment and used as slaves. Stalin, in response, issued order number 227, and it was a pretty simple order, not a step back, exclamation point. So basically, a battle formed up where there was an immovable object on one side and an irresistible force on the other, and it was a fight to the death for everyone involved. If you fought, you would die. If you ran away, they would kill you. If you were captured, you were going to die. So it was total war. And I can't hardly imagine anything that portrays Satan and his mind more clearly than what took place. Again, it ended up being one of the most brutal battles of the war. The Russian forces suffered tremendous losses, but continued to fight until they finally encircled the city. The German 6th Army then was contained within the city, along with some Allied forces, not Allied, Axis forces at that time. And that was 300,000 troops. And they basically slowly starved out and ran out of ammunition. When the Russian forces were finally able to conquer the city, Hitler had refused to allow any surrender at all. He just, no, you will not surrender. You will not disgrace your country. You will fight and you will die. There was about 100,000 soldiers left to be captured when the battle ended. 75,000 of those died within 3 months, basically on the forced marches to the camps where they would be interned. Estimates are about 6,000 of those soldiers made it back home after the war was over. 6,000. Tremendous, unbelievable carnage. Total war. That's what Satan's mind is like. That's what Satan does. He's the god of war. My dad joined the Army in World War II. He was an artillery officer in the Pacific Campaign. He never really talked about it much. You could get him to talk a little bit about some activity they had, but I don't remember him ever actually talking about the war itself. In the basement in our house was a glass jar full of medals. And I don't know, maybe it was a pint jar, but it was literally full of medals. There were medals and stars and ribbons and insignias and various things. So it wasn't like nothing took place. There was something that actually took place and was recognized. But my dad just never said much. My oldest brother eventually took that with him and has it to this day. Never did find out. In my mind, I couldn't go back now and tell you what was in the jar. It, again, it's probably in a shelf somewhere in my brother's house. But Dad went to war. He fought in that war, and he got a bunch of medals. When I was dating Michelle, stepping on down to my own time and my own life, and we began to be more than socially dating, but there was more of a commitment began to form and take place. There, I figured, you know, there's some things in my life that I need her to know, and I'm going to have that discussion. So because of where I had been, the first thing I told her one time, sitting there together, was that there was a child out there somewhere. Didn't know if it was a boy or a girl. I'd never gone back to check out. I heard that the mother had married, but I really didn't know for sure. And that it wouldn't be unsurprising in my life down the road at some point where a child looks around to see who daddy is and if he even cares. And so I let her know that that was out there. I had no way to know how that would play or what that circumstance would be. The good news is our son, Brad, is restored, and we do have a wonderful relationship with him. But that took a process of quite a few years, and there were twists and turns along the way. But then I told her something else. I said, there are things in my life that I will never tell you, and you are not to ask. And you're not going to know what they are. You can't ask. I have been to war. There are things in my life that I will take with me to the grave, and they'll be over. There's no gain. There's no purpose. The problem is, if you haven't actually been to war, and I don't mean watching it from a desk, I mean in it, chances are probably rather high you don't quite understand what it is. I don't think it comes out of watching the movies. It certainly is improved by reading sometimes some of the books. But the honest answer is, it changes things. Values are different. Circumstances are unusual and not even understandable to an average person who hasn't been there. I joined the Army in 1970. I spent all of 1971 in Vietnam. Went there in early January, left there in late December. I was an infantry soldier by choice. I turned down the offers for schools and technical training that would put me in some other place. When I got out of my officer NCO school, my non-commissioned officer training, they sent our unit to Germany, and I had to actually request orders for Vietnam. But it was there because I had chosen. So I went through that, and I would just say I try to find maybe a gentle example of just how dramatically things change under those circumstances. I was wounded in Vietnam, had 10 days in a regional hospital. Then there was a regulation that said, well, you can't just stay there. So then they sent me to Japan for a month for rehabilitation. After basically being drunk for a month in Japan, I went back to Vietnam, and they were going to send me back out to the field. So I sat down. You have a couple days duty to make transition to go back out to the field, and they had a poker game that night, so I sat down to play poker. When got me my own personal drink, it was a quart bottle of Seagram 7. Sat my quart bottle on the table, spent the evening playing cards, drank the entire quart myself, won at cards, and got up and went on duty in the morning. Now, you do not do that without a period of living your life very, very hard. There was no time quite like that before the Army, and there certainly has not been any time like that since. But I use that as an illustration that it's hard sometimes for people to understand when the rules change so dramatically in a circumstance that when you're in it, it looks normal. When you're outside of it, it looks quite strange. There are far more graphic examples of that I could give, but that's not my point. My point is that war is not a normal environment. Unless you've been there, you may not quite understand what it means. And here's the problem. The church is in a war with Satan. And quite frankly, Satan is in a war with the entire world, and we're in that, and it impacts us, and sometimes we don't realize what the consequences are or just how graphic and dramatic those things are going to be, and frankly, have been. Look at Acts chapter 8. The Apostle Paul wrote about war. He uses the analogy over and over in his writings. Well, of course he does, because he did understand it. He had been in it, and he's writing now from that reference point. Acts chapter 8, verse number 1. Saul was consenting to his death, Stephen's death. He was murdered, and Saul was there. At that time, a great persecution arose against the church was at Jerusalem. They were all scattered throughout the regions of Judea, Samaria, except the apostles and devout men carried Stephen to his burial and made great lamentation over him. As for Saul, he went to war. He made havoc of the church, entered every house, dragging off men and women, committing them to prison. When you've watched someone be murdered, it's not something that just walks away and recesses somewhere in your mind. It's part of your process. It's something you think about. Paul was part of that. Acts chapter 9, Saul, verse 1, still breathing threats and murder against the disciples of the Lord, went to the high priest and asked letters from him for the synagogues of Damascus, so that if he found any who were of the way, whether men or women, he might bring them bound to Jerusalem. He was still fighting the war, and he had a bloodlust in God's service, of course, to get the job done. Paul thought about that. I've often wondered, how was Paul able to take the beatings, the sufferings, the humiliation, and not begrudge it and become embittered? And it's because Paul said, you know what? I did that myself. I did that to people who now look to me for their instruction and their encouragement. 1 Corinthians 15, verse number 9, Paul said, I am the least of the apostles. I'm not worthy to be called an apostle because I persecuted the church of God. But by the grace of God, I am what I am, and his grace toward me was not in vain. I labored more abundantly than they all, yet not I, but the grace of God which was with me. Therefore, whether it was I or they, we preached, and so you believed. Now, that's in the middle of a story. And my point is only to illustrate Paul's perspective. He said, I persecuted the church. And I think that's part of what allowed Paul to be willing to then suffer persecution himself and not begrudge it, because he had done that as well. 2 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse number 22 is a little longer passage, but Paul begins to then speak about all of the suffering that he did indeed face. And I think I can easily recognize and say, you have not suffered like this, and neither have I. We haven't faced these kinds of things. But you know what? Life's not over. There are sicknesses that are traumatic and long-term, and the struggles, quite frankly, that people, individuals face are only known by the persons themselves. We can't really feel and understand what people go through except on a more personal way. For 2 Corinthians 11, verse 22, he says, are they Hebrews? Now again, he's making a comparison in the middle of a story. My point is not the story, but the response. Well, so am I. Are they Israelites? Well, so am I. Are they the seed of Abraham? Well, so am I. Are they ministers of Christ? He says, I speak as a fool. And I wrote down in my notes, the New Living Translation, he says, I know I sound like a madman. I'm spouting off and it sounds almost too dramatic. But he says, I am more. Labors more abundant, stripes above measure, prisons more frequently, deaths often. From the Jews 5 times I received 40 stripes minus one. 3 times beaten with rods, 1 he was stoned, 3 he was shipwrecked. A night and a day I've been in the deep, journeys often, perils in waters, perils of robbers, perils of my own countrymen, perils of the Gentiles, perils in the city, in the wilderness, in the sea, among false brethren, in weariness and toil, in sleeplessness often, hunger and thirst, in fastings often, cold and nakedness. And he says, besides that, I have the needs and the care for the church. Who is weak and I am not weak? Who is made to stumble and I do not burn with indignation? That's war. Paul had been in it. He had been beaten, humiliated, run out of town, punished. And he would get up, and he would continue on, And I don't think there's hardly any of us can fully understand what he went through. I can't. And I've been to war. But I haven't been to that war. That was a little different. Members of the Church of God, over many decades of time, not so much recently because we don't have an active draft, at least here in the United States, facing military service were often considered to be conscientious objectors. They considered themselves to be conscientious objectors. And a word for that that is sometimes used in its place is a pacifist. Now, the words aren't identical, but I'm just saying those are used interchangeably. So members of the Church of God were considered to be pacifists, and many considered themselves to be such as well. A pacifist is someone who's opposed to violence as a means of settling disputes. You know, there's a difference between being a pacifist physically and being one spiritually, and that's the problem. Sometimes the Church of God members, from my perspective, are actual spiritual pacifists, because the strongest statement is whatever you do, you know, the battle cry in the Church of God is don't cause division. Whatever you do, don't cause division. Well, what it ought to be is whatever you do, you make sure you put God the Father first. But somehow or other, that got missed out on the equation, because the Church of God was taught to take orders, to do their duty, to be kind to one another, to not make waves. And if you didn't agree, you kind of buttoned it. And if you didn't agree even more, then you had to walk away. There's a difference between not wanting to settle disputes with violence and not being willing to stand up for the truth. I think one of the deepest disappointments that I've had in my 40 years of service in the ministry and employment in the church is the time came when you said something that was true, and there were people who recognized it was true and thanked you for saying it and encouraged you to keep saying it. And then when you were in trouble for having said it, now what they wanted you to do is just to sit down and don't cause division. That's like being a pacifist spiritually. I don't think that's a noble attribute. I don't think Christ came to bring peace on the earth in his day. And I don't think when the disciples went out and preached the gospel that they brought peace on the earth in their day. They would have certainly brought peace to the individual between that person and God, and hopefully between that person and his brother. But when the brother says, just shut up and sit down so that we can have our peace, if what you did was put God first, then maybe that's not the answer. Maybe that's not the answer that should have been given. Go to the Feast of Tabernacles. How many years? And the song, Onward Christian Soldiers, is in the hymn book. And you know, you stand up, you rise, and everyone starts singing this marching song, and it's actually a beat where you could march to it, and the voices rise, and the hearts pound, and then you sit down when it's all over, you go to lunch with your friends. That was the war. Well, it was an emotional response, but that wasn't really the war. But I've heard that song. I've sung it. Your voice rises, and wow, what an excitement that is. All right, now, let's go do the mini golf, and then this evening we'll go out to a nice place to eat. I think something's got missed in the course of our value system, what we were committed to, and what needed to be done. Various countries around the world now are in the process of being brought to their knees. And the Church of God is not going to be immune from the effects of that problem that is boiling out now of the circumstances we all face. We can blame any trouble that descends on the church as the problem of the sins of our nations. We can do that. But we're also going to have to be accountable for our own, for what we have done, for what we have not done. And I give you one example that I think is central to it all. Preaching that Jesus Christ is the God of the Old Testament is a false gospel And the Church of God has preached it for 70 years. You think God ever gets to the point where he just says, I don't want to hear that anymore? It denies the presence and role of God the Father in his creation. It replaces him with Jesus Christ. Nothing comes before our Father. That message used to be muted. I know people said, well, that's not what did we believe that? Is that what we were teaching? I mean, it's like they didn't even notice. Well, now it's being shouted from the housetops. I really don't believe God's going to put up with that forever. He has a lot of patience. He has a lot of mercy. There's a difference between being uninformed, and many of us were uninformed, there's no question. But there's a difference between that and being belligerent. And there's more belligerence today than there used to be. With ignorance, God has mercy. I'm not saying that without knowledge, then you're incomplete. No, you're incomplete without God. God opens our mind to understand. When he opens our mind, we better do something. We better respond. Knowledge is important, but faithfulness is measured more by sincerity than understanding. So when our understanding increases, then our sincerity needs to follow. We need to do the right thing. Luke 16, verse number 10. Again, some of the scriptures I pulled on this, because this is not really a doctrinal sermon, but it's principle I want to address. So I break into the middle of a context, at least in part of this, because of only the point I want to make. But Luke 16, verse number 10, he who is faithful in what is least, God gives you a little bit, and you're faithful. Well, he's faithful also in much. God doesn't need to give you much necessarily if you're faithful in what you have. He has his answer. He who is unjust in what is least is unjust also in much. Same answer. But God does need to know where we are and how we will be. Luke 18, verse number 1, my Bible says it's the parable of the persistent widow. It says he spoke a parable to them that men always ought to pray and not lose heart, saying, there was a certain city, a judge who did not fear God, nor regard man, nor is there, and now there was a widow in the city, and she came to him, saying, get justice for me from my adversary. He would not for a while, but afterwards he said within himself, though I do not fear God, nor regard man, yet because this widow troubles me, I'll avenge her by a continual coming, she weary me. Then the Lord said, hear what the unjust judge said. The lesson isn't that we should be an unjust judge. The lesson is the point that Christ is going to make. Shall not God, who is much more than some unjust judge, shall not God avenge his own elect who cry out day and night to him, even though he bears long with them? He's patient and he lets things sometimes play because he needs to see where their heart will be. I tell you, he will avenge them speedily. Nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes, will he really find faith on the earth? How many people are going to be left that are even going to be willing to put God first? How many people are willing to go against their friends, their family? Talking to a friend in the church today, explaining to me how many of the friends that they used to have no longer speak to them, talk to them, communicate with them. Friends that were deep and long, and associations that were long held and dear. Luke 19, just going on over a little bit. Verse number 26, parable of the minas. I learned parable of the pounds when I first was reading the King James. There was, you know, different amounts. Everyone was given one, but some made a lot, 10, some made 5. Then another person just kept on to the one they had. You know, I think we read this sometimes, there's only one bad problem in it. There's only the one person. Well, it doesn't actually tell you what happened to all 10. It just tells you what happened to 3. If history is any guide, there were problems more than the parable portrays. But go down to verse 26. It just says, I say to you that everyone who has will be given, and from him who does not have, even what he has will be taken away. You either grow, you show faithfulness, you show integrity, you make a commitment. You do not back away and turn aside your face from those who put God first. God will bless you. He will increase you. He will care for you. Sometimes I was almost like you would stand up in the middle of a group of people and you could almost watch the heads turn away. Your friends, long-term relationships in some cases. Satan is the god of war. And he plays with us as he has been allowed to a degree, within a range, sifting us within the range God allows, because God wants to see our heart and where it will be. Satan is the god of war, 1 Peter 5. I'm going to recommend a few books today. The reason is they're books that describe in graphic detail some of the types of events that are portrayed by Scripture. They're books that I read that actually helped me comprehend conceptually what it is here that takes place. 1 Peter 5, verse number 6. It says, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you in due time, casting all your care upon him, for he cares for you. Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. Total war, complete destruction. That's what Satan wants, but he wants to win. One of the books I read many years ago was The Man-Eaters of Kameon by Jim Corbett. Goes back to the late 1800s, early 1900s. I'd have to go back and check what the dates were on it. Anything by Jim Corbett, he hunted out many of the man-eating tigers in the Indian subcontinent. And the stories are all of the hunts. The stories are the times when he's walking down the trail hunting a man-eating tiger that has maybe eaten a few hundred people and has survived enough to get that far down the line, get the body count as high as it was, and then turn around and walk back the other way and the tiger tracks were on the trail behind him. Yeah, it's a pretty amazing story. I used to hike in the regional area, the inland northwest, training for mountaineering, and I would take a pack, fill it full of gallons of water, you haul it to the top of the hill, pour all the water out so I could go back down without blowing out my knees, because I was moving as fast as I could. One time above Kellogg, I went over the ridge to the top of a line of ridges and on a trail. It was a light dusting of snow, and I walked through, and as I came back down, I could see my footprints until I got to where the cougar tracks were on the same trail. And I just thought, well, isn't that amazing? I'm walking up this trail by myself. I got my handy flashlight in my pocket. It was like an LED light, a little tiny one. And there's a cougar walking up behind me. Well, you know, I'm here. He got his lunch somewhere else. But it says Satan is like that. He wants to devour us. Now, there's another book that I've read, The Man-Eaters of Tsavo, and it's from J.H. Patterson, which again goes way back into that same basic time frame. It's, if you see it in a movie, just forget it. These are not movies. I mean, movies help in certain ways, but sometimes you got to just read the author himself tell his own story. J.H. Patterson. The lions, the man-eaters, that, again, just literally ravaged a line where they were building a railroad back in East Africa. Those lions are now mounted in the Chicago Field Museum. I've actually seen them. They're under-impressive because they were carpet on the floor in Patterson's house for many years, and when he donated them to the museum, they had to trim them up and then sew them together. So it's impressive that you know what happened, but they were actually much larger animals in the original context. But reading those stories, those specific stories, helped me understand just what a man-eating, you know, lion or tiger or beast or Satan ravaging around like that, what that would be. Sometime Michelle, a while back, not even recently, but further back than that, was struggling to understand some of the events in her life. And there were a series of difficulties. Everyone has their own. And like I say, we're nowhere near suffering what others have suffered. But she was trying to understand it. And finally, she said what helped her, she just considered that we're all in the trenches. Well, the trenches are in the very front of the battle. And you're in the trenches, and the enemy is right there on the other side. And she said, you know what? I realized, because you keep waiting for this to pass, and you keep waiting for it to go away, and you keep waiting for the sun to come out and the grass turn green and everything to be comfortable again. And she said, I finally realized there were no reinforcements. You hold your position. You remain faithful to the end. She said, that helped me somehow to recognize that, no, this is it. This is where I am. This is what we're going to do. And we're just going to do it. No cavalry's coming over the mountain necessarily and relieve you. You're going to be relieved when you are, but until you hold your position and you remain faithful to the end. And she said, somehow that just helped her to understand what her responsibility should be. 2 Corinthians chapter 2, verse number 3, starting in verse number 3. Again, in the middle of a context here where there was trouble in the church, and Paul is telling them, look, you put the man out, I told you to, now bring him back and receive him. Restore him. Let me go down to verse number 5. He says, if anyone has caused grief, he has not grieved me, but all of you to some extent, not to be too severe, this punishment which was inflicted by the majority is sufficient for such a man, so that on the contrary, you ought rather to forgive and comfort him, lest perhaps such a one be swallowed up with too much sorrow. Therefore, I urge you to reaffirm your love to him, for to this end I also wrote that I might put you to the test, whether you're obedient in all things. Now, whom you forgive anything, I also forgive. For indeed, I have forgiven anything, I have forgiven that one for your sakes in the presence of Christ, lest Satan should take advantage of us. We are not ignorant of his devices. So the point is, there's ways in which Satan has his devices, his war instruments that he uses to try to take us out. And Paul said, you know what? Let's not let Satan drive us as be the wedge. Let's be cognizant of what he does. So if you have a set of my notes, you'll see that I referenced now a few of the different devices of Satan that I considered, at least those that I wanted to share. Those of you that have my notes this time might be impressed the fact that there aren't spelling errors, because I turned the spell checker on my computer, finally. I didn't realize that I write my notes in all caps, and it's not because I'm shouting, even though I am shouting. They're in all caps because I can see them and read them, and I found the upper lowercase hard to read on a glance. But when you put it in all caps, then the spell checker doesn't check it anymore unless you go in there and check the box and make it do its work. So we should have better spelling in the future going forward. But under Satan's devices, the first one I listed was Satan gets us to compromise our principles. It's always compromise. Well, you can just turn the corner just a little sooner. Well, you can just work a little less hard. You can actually receive the benefits without having done all of that kind of effort. You do not look at your bank account when you decide whether or not you're going to steal. This isn't a matter of, is it going to work or is it not? This isn't a matter of, will I get away with it or will anybody know? You live your life so that when you get up in the morning, you can look in the mirror. And that's what comes back to my mind. Literally, some of my companions, how do you get up and look in the mirror if you know something's to be true and you said it was true and then you turn around and deny that it was true in order to receive some benefit? How do you look in the mirror? Brethren, we live our lives so that we look in the mirror and we not be ashamed. We have had a fish pond in our backyard. And then we made the decision to get Winston Churchill, our dog. We don't use Churchill, but it's Winston. He's a big dog. He's mixed of Bouvier and poodle and retriever and mutt. But he's got a lot of hair, and he loved that water. And he'd get in the water, and then he'd come run in the house. I got to where I had two mops in the house. Follow around, mop up behind him. Afterwards, I said, you know what, this is not working. So we got rid of the fish pond this last week. We dug it up, pulled it out, filled the hole in, covered it over with some pavers to kind of expand the patio, took the fish pond, biggest one we could buy at the time on the market that was available to us, and cleaned it all up, put it out in the front of the driveway free. You can have this free. Guy comes up in a pickup. Who wants it? Well, it wasn't even a pickup. Now I think it was a car. Well, how are you going to get this on your car? Well, I don't know. It's bigger than my car. Well, here's some straps. I had straps, nice straps, buckles on them in my toolbox. So I had in the straps, and he strapped this thing on his car, and it was all free. And I said, just drop straps off when you're done. As he drove away, I turned to Michelle, and I said, you know what? Don't imagine necessarily those straps are going to return. You know, not yet. They haven't. And I won't say I've given up hope because I really don't care. I shared. That's enough. If he brings them back, then he's honorable. If he doesn't, you know what? It's not my problem. So the straps are gone up to this moment. I don't worry about that. I can't. It's not my issue. Satan wants to give us the benefit, the opportunity, the time when nobody's looking. He wants to give us a little bit of cover of darkness, and then he's going to present his offer. And what he wants us to do, you know, if you'll just compromise a little, if you're faithful in little, you're fine. But if you're unfaithful in little, it doesn't matter how much it is. God knows. Isaiah 45 is a scripture that talks about righteousness in a way that is just absolutely, to me, it's what we would certainly want, and the way God intends it to be. Isaiah 45, verse number 1, thus says Jehovah to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I have held. So God will work with who he will, and he'll open the door for someone to fulfill his will and call him his anointed. It has nothing to do with Cyrus being God's, well, he's his servant, but he's not certainly by God's spirit in terms of internal. To subdue nations before him, loose the armor of kings, open before him the double doors so that the gates will not be shut. So God is going to have his way. And then go down to verse number 4. It says, for Jacob my servant's sake, and Israel my elect, I have even called you by your name. I have named you, though you have not known me. I'm Jehovah. There is no other. There is no God besides me. Are there any Elohims besides Jehovah? Well, actually, yes. So does it mean there's only one Elohim? Actually, no. It is only one Jehovah Elohim. It can't be otherwise and then fit all of the other scriptures. I will gird you though you have not known me, that they may know from the rising of the sun to its setting that there is none besides me. I'm Jehovah, there is no other. I form the light and create darkness. I make peace, create calamity. I, Jehovah, do all these things. He oversees all the process whereby he proves and tests us to see if we will put him first. And then it says, rain down, you heavens, from above. Let the skies pour down righteousness. Let the skies pour down righteousness. Let the earth open. Let them bring forth salvation. You know, it's like the resurrection now coming up in the fruit of righteousness. Let righteousness spring up together. I, Jehovah, have created it. Let it rain down righteousness and bear the fruit of those who drink in the rain and produce much fruitfulness in response. I love the passage. I just love the concept of like standing out in the rain and just being soaking wet, but it's righteousness, it's purity, it's truth. It's not compromise. It's not mixed. It's not temporary. It's true. Another device of Satan is that he distracts our focus. We all know that. We've all experienced it. I wrecked our pickup truck a few years ago. There was somebody on the corner that was there hoping for a gift and a handout for money. And they maintained a certain corner. And the way the setup, I would analyze as I went by what the setup was. You know, one day there's a walker, one day there's no walker. One day there's a dog, one day there's no dog. One day there's a bandage, one day, I can't measure all of it. But I'm analytical. I'm watching. And so I'm driving up in our truck, which had manual brakes, and you had to kind of be on them to be ready. And I looked up, the light turned green, there was a car in front of me. I looked over and I saw the person on the side of the street, and I stopped and I began to analyze what the request was that was being made. Michelle and I prefer to try to help through agencies as compared to someone on the street. We have no idea what the circumstances might be, so we've tried to direct our assistance in that way. But I watched her for a second. Then I looked back, and the car in front of me had taken off, and then something happened. Someone came out in the intersection and stopped, and I just ran right into him. You know, it's just, I think of that. It's just a moment. Catch your guy. Catch your glance. Catch your mind. Catch your thought. Catch a picture. Something on the internet, something on your computer, something in your history, something in your relationship. Satan distracts our focus. A book for that, C.S. Lewis, The Screwtape Letters. Read it years ago. A relative of mine gave me a whole set of his books, and I read that one and kind of marked through it. Screwtape here is a veteran demon who writes letters to his nephew, Wormwood. And quite frankly, the writing is brilliant. It truly is brilliant, I believe. And it was first published in World War II in response to what was taking place in the war and the attitudes and the compromises and the things that were then taking place. And that was what it was in response to. But here you have a demon, a veteran, you know, one of the senior ones. And he advises his nephew to promote anxiety and division and instability and hopelessness, lethargy, pride, selfishness. And you know what else? Prosperity. Promote prosperity. They will lose their focus. And each letter reasons through how that takes place and what's the best way to install those things. And then they're to discourage prayer and expressions of love and humility and sacrifice. It's a pretty fascinating read, actually. So I think sometimes, in terms of Satan's devices, there are individuals that have gifts who have been able to share their descriptions in ways that are helpful to picture them more clearly. I am concerned that the Church of God does not truly understand war because they're pacifists And that's good in terms of resolving disputes. But when your physical actions become your spiritual actions, and the mantra is, whatever you do, don't cause division. No, that's not good enough. That's not going to work. That's not what Christ did. Certainly not what the disciples did. We don't trample each other. We don't show each other disrespect. We show each other honor by doing the right thing and by encouraging each other to continue to do the right thing. Psalm 73. I wrote the whole psalm in my notes. I don't know if I'll get through all of it, but I want to read at least part of it. Truly God is good to Israel, to such as are pure in heart. But as for me, my feet had almost stumbled. My steps had nearly slipped. I was envious of the boastful when I saw the prosperity of the wicked. There are no pangs in their death. Their strength is firm. They're not in trouble like other men, nor they're plagued like other men. Therefore, pride serves as their necklace. Violence covers them like a garment. Their eyes bulge with abundance. They have more heart than the heart could wish. They scoff and speak wickedly concerning oppression. They speak loftily. They set their mouth against the heavens. Their tongue walks through the earth. Boy, there's times when I really wanted certain individuals to receive a little taste of justice. I did. I wanted it. Now, I don't want so much for me to receive the same. And so there should be a check on our concerns, because sometimes, quite frankly, if it's good for the goose, certainly it's good for us, maybe. God is very patient and merciful. But the psalmist here is just writing on how tough it is sometimes to turn around and see people take advantage, seem to be blessed, seem to receive increase. And while those around them then who are actually more righteous than they suffer. Therefore, as people return here and waters of a full cup are drained by them. They say, well, how does God know? Is there knowledge in the Most High? Behold, these are the ungodly who are always at ease. They increase in riches. Surely I've cleansed my heart in vain. I've washed my hands in innocence. All day long I've been plagued and chastened every morning. I obeyed, I served, and I was punished. That's a bitter pill sometimes. If I had said, I'll speak thus, behold, I would have been untrue to the generation of your children. When I thought how to understand this, it was too painful for me until I went into the sanctuary of God, and then I understood their end. It is not about what happens today. It is what the end of the matter will be. There are very few things in this life that I would ever do over again. Very few choices I've made in terms of where I've served and how I've gone and things I did. Honestly, would I do it again? No, I would not do it again. Did it need to be done? Probably so. Did God want me to do it? Well, I think he needed to show me what I needed to learn. When I went into the sanctuary of God, then I understood their end. Surely you set them in slippery places, cast them down to destruction. Oh, how they are brought to desolation as in a moment. They are utterly consumed with terrors. As a dream when one awakes, so Lord, when you awake, you shall despise their image. When you rise up and you make judgment, they're going to have their accounting. Thus my heart was grieved. I was vexed in my mind. I was so foolish and ignorant. I was like a beast before you. Nevertheless, I'm continually with you. You hold me by my right hand. You will guide me with your counsel. Afterward, receive me to glory. Whom have I in heaven but you? And there is none upon earth that I desire besides you. My flesh and my heart fail, but God is the strength of my heart. I love God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. Indeed, those who are far from you shall perish. You have destroyed all those who desert you for harlotry. It is good for me to draw near to God. I have put my trust in Jehovah God that I may declare all your works. Well, I guess I just had to read it all. Another device of Satan is he inflames our passions and desires. That's what I feel good that I have so few passions and desires, it's hard to inflame them. My passions and desires are in flames as I sit in the rocking chair sometimes, I think. Proverbs 6, verse number 20, is a warning. And I think probably on this one, I'm just going to dip down into it. Verse 27. We're going to just read the very midst of it. It's talking about being tempted. It's talking about being carried away by your temptations. You know what it is? You see something, you don't think, I don't want to think about that. But then you stare at it. Well, then you start to think about it. Then you start to imagine it. Then you start to desire it. Well, you know what? At some point in time, it's just not going to work. It's just not going to work. If you knew somebody was watching, a friend, we know God's watching, but we kind of discount that. We can get used to that. It'd stop, you wouldn't do it. But no, it carries on. But verse 27, can a man take fire to his bosom and his clothes not be burned? Of course not. But we reason, when Satan inflames our passions and desires and emotions, that somehow or other we can justify what it is that we're about to do. Can one walk on hot coals and his feet not be seared? They cannot. You will get burned. Not just in the end, you're going to be burned today. Be burned today. We sometimes live our lives taking dangerous risks with our own salvation because we do not contain and limit our emotions, our passions, and our desires. That's what Satan wants. He wants to win. He wants to be our master. So I used the example in a sermon some years ago. Michelle has reminded me of it sometimes. What is Satan going to do? Well, you just figure out what it is that you want the most and you don't have it. What is it you desire that you're still waiting on? Satan will search that out. You know what? Chances are, possibly, he'll offer it to you, but now it's coming from him. So there will be some pretty heavy strings attached to that one when it comes your way. You want to be a little bit careful about that. That there's another thing. There's things that we each have that we will not let go. In other words, they are the most important thing to us. You're going to have to wrestle me for it. You know what? Satan will. He'll wrestle you for it. If he can take it away, he can cause you to be offended. If you're offended, then that's hard to heal. So Satan goes in and tries to find, he tests us, he watches us to see where it is that we are exposed, and that's where he'll go in. But if there's a weak spot, if there's a weakness, he let that be accentuated. We were watching a war movie the other day, I forget which one it even was, but the guy got shot and they were questioning him and they didn't like that he wasn't answering the question, so they would just stick their foot on the place that he'd been shot and grind their foot on him, and you know, he was very uncomfortable. I think Satan, if there's a sore spot, he's going to try to take that to advantage. If there's something that we really, really deeply want, you know what, he might try to just hand it to us. But then it comes from him. Proverbs 30 is another verse that has always been kind of interesting to me, because it's a verse that shows, well, you know, the answer is somewhere not on one end or the other. The answer is somewhere in the middle. Proverbs 30, verse 7, two things I request of you, deprive me not before I die. Remove falsehood and lies far from me. All right, that's an easy one to say. Try praying this one. Give me neither poverty nor riches. Whatever you do, don't give me too much. Don't give me too nice of a car, too nice of a house. Don't give me too many things. Don't let me go do that thing I always wanted. Don't let me do that. That's not the way we're going to tend to pray, but give me neither poverty nor riches, because there's a reason. Feed me with the food allotted to me, lest I be full and deny you and say, who is Jehovah? lest I be poor and steal and profane the name of my God. Abraham was rich and wealthy. Abraham was the father of the faithful. So God doesn't say we can't be increased. But the point here that's being expressed is wisdom. It says, look, don't let me have so little that I cry out and profane in some way, your name. But don't let me have so much that I lose focus. If that's what it is, I don't want it. None of us should. Another device of Satan is to sap our energy and wear us down. Just drain us out and to where you just don't want to deal with anything. I was on a wrestling team when I was in junior high. I hated it. It was brutal. I had no idea. You're out there wrestling, and if you're winning, it's not too bad, all right? You kind of feel like there's a goal in mind. If you're losing, now we got a problem. How long am I going to struggle before I lose? Is there any way I can just get it over with and it look good like I really tried, even though I didn't? I'm telling you, it went through my mind when I was losing on that mat. How long am I going to suffer? And I could suffer a little and lose, or a lot and lose. I'm still going to lose. Suffering little seems better to me. I finished the assignment on whatever that was for the semester, and I just went on something else. In junior high, I just didn't have what it took to be in that kind of a sport. Satan will wear you down to the point where you say, you know what, I think I just lose and get it over with. I'll quit. Painted the house years ago, painted the eaves on the house, I don't know, 15 years ago. I took down the gutters so I could paint the eaves. Don't tell Michelle, but we still don't have gutters back up. You know what we do have? We actually have marks on the cement where the water drains off, and it actually has dented the cement, or dissolved, or whatever the term would be. And the pavers on the patio have the same thing. Not real bad, but I figured another 15 years is safe. But the rain dripping off the roof is wearing away the concrete. Well, isn't that amazing? Satan's got time. He's got time on his hands. He can wear us down. He can kind of slowly grind us away. He can continually add a little bit of stress. And you know what? It'll be a drip, 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 drip. At some point in time, we got to be careful, brethren, that we don't begin to give way. Because Satan's got more time than we've got. He certainly has that. But in the end, he'll have no time at all. 2 Corinthians 4. Again, Paul writing in terms of his ministry. Since we have this ministry, verse 1, as we have received mercy, we do not lose heart. We don't quit. Don't back up. Don't sign off. We don't go away. We have renounced the hidden things of shame, not walking in craftiness, nor handling the word of God deceitfully, but by manifestation of the truth, commending ourselves to every man's conscience in the sight of God. Even if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing, whose minds the God of this age has blinded, who do not believe, lest the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God, should shine on them. We do not preach ourselves, but Christ Jesus the Lord, and ourselves your bondservants for Jesus' sake. It is the God who commanded light to shine out of darkness, who has shown in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. Paul said, we do not lose heart. God is on his throne. Jesus Christ is his servant. He is our master. We serve him fully and faithfully, and it's going to be okay. As long as you continue and endure to the end, it's going to be okay. Whatever that will be. So my bookshelves in my office, an entire wall of my office, one whole wall is nothing but bookshelves. And many of those stories are stories of adventure, exploration, survival, sacrifice, leadership, examples by individuals that I considered to be helpful or beneficial. And you know what? They weren't, for me, entertainment. They were, for me, education. I read a story of, again, I've got a whole stack of books just on who survives and who doesn't survive and why. I read a story of a man who was got thrown off his boat in the ocean. It's been a few years back, but he was in the ocean and he could see the shore and he was swimming and the tow kept pulling him back a little bit and the currents kept pulling him and he's going to get washed out to sea. And he kept struggling and struggling and struggling. And the battle was that it was like being on the wrestling team. All of a sudden, drowning began to look like your friend. You can rest. It'll be release. It's not that painful, actually, to drown. And all of a sudden, giving up became a solution. It became the way out. And he had to fight that in his mind. And we have to fight that in our mind. Because, well, Satan will give us the answer, and the answer is just stop. Let it go. Quit working so hard to do those things. That's the danger. The danger is when our own destruction looks like a friend and a release from our agony and frustration, we can just get it over with and be done. That just isn't God's way. You know, this is a little bit oblique to that, but I put it in my notes because I wanted to say so. If you're single and you're lonely and you're struggling, okay, that's kind of understandable at a certain age and based on what our desires would be. But let me just give one little piece of advice in terms of how this struggle plays. Do not marry someone who is unhappy, because marry someone who is successful, not unable to fulfill, because it's not going to change. Marry someone who will continue to swim to shore, no matter what. Not going to quit. Not going to say, just take me, it's over. Not going to say, well, I was happy until I was here, but I'm not happy anymore. Marry someone that'll keep swimming. Make the best of it. Do what needs to be done. And you do the same. You do the same. Finally, on a device, Satan feeds us his own cup. How would you like to drink from Satan's cup? He does. He'll let you drink from his own cup. 1 Corinthians 10, verse number 14. My beloved, flee from idolatry. I speak as to wise men. Judge for yourself what I say. The cup of blessing which we bless, is it not the communion of the blood of Christ? The bread which we break, is it not the communion of the body of Christ? For we, though many, are one bread and one body. We all partake of that one bread. Observe Israel after the flesh. Are not those who eat of the sacrifices partakers of the altar? What am I saying then? That an idol is anything? No, the idol is a piece of stone, or it's an image, or it's a thought. It's sin if you partake of it, but it's just a thing. But notice, or what is offered to idols, is that anything? Rather, that the things with the Gentiles sacrifice, they sacrifice to demons, not to God. I do not want you to have fellowship with demons. You cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. Satan has his own cup, and it's filled to the full with bitterness and strife and anger and animosity and unforgiving attitudes and expressions. Satan will let you drink from that cup. You cannot partake of the Lord's table and the table of demons. It simply cannot be done. So a final book that I would recommend is The Hiding Place by Corrie ten Boom. It's kind of evangelical. You can live through the evangelical part of the book. But it's a true story. It's a very famous book. It's an old story. But it certainly had an impact in terms when I first read it, and I've kept that book on my shelf. The book is an account of Corrie ten Boom's experiences in the Dutch resistance during World War II. And during the war, she was put in the Ravensbrück concentration camp, and her sister died there in the camp. They went in together, and her father was taken away, never returned, so they don't even, I don't think they even found out whatever happened to their father. But her sister, before she died, encouraged Corrie to be forgiving, continually admonishing her to be forgiving. And that took some time. But after she was released, she actually opened up a house, a home for war victims who had nowhere to go. Some of the victims that she housed were the informers, because society rejected them after the war. They didn't even have a house that they could go to where they would be accepted. And here's what she said in addressing forgiveness. She said, "I knew it not only as a commandment of God, but as a daily experience. Since the end of the war, I had had a home in Holland for victims of Nazi brutality. Those who were able to forgive their former enemies were able also to return to the outside world and rebuild their lives, no matter what the physical scars. Those who nursed their bitterness remained invalids. It was as simple and as horrible as that. Those who forgave healed. Those who did not forgive did not heal. If you nurse your grudge, your anger, your sorrow, your bitterness, it will make you sick. It will kill you in the end." Satan's offer is continuous war. God's offer is everlasting peace. Boy, what a difference. What a dramatic difference in context. John 14, verse number 25. John 14:25, laid out pretty clearly here. Christ speaking, he said, "These things I have spoken to you while being present with you, but the Helper, the Holy Spirit, whom the Father will send in my name, he will teach you all things and bring to your remembrance all things which I said to you. Peace I leave with you, my peace I give to you. Not as the world gives do I give to you. Let your heart not be troubled, neither let it be afraid." My childhood at times, I've looked back, I think was frankly a train wreck. My mom died at a year and a half old, and I despised my father, even though there was social exchange. I didn't want to be like him in any way. 1969, I graduated from high school. In the course of a discussion in our living room, we got in an argument, and I just walked out the door. Now, we had a measure of truce after that. Reconciliation did not take place until God called me, and I came to repentance, and I reached out to him, and he responded. I was the one who had to change. So 1989, then on down the line, I sat with my dad at an airport on one of the trips back home, and our relationship had been restored. You could sit in the gates then together, because it was before the current circumstance. And I asked him, sitting there together, how long it took him to get over my mother's death. Mom died in 1952. Dad was recovering from polio. There was some real trauma that rolled through our family. My mother had encephalitis. She had a fever of 108, 109 degrees. She was in the hospital for 3 weeks, four different hospitals. She was conscious in that for only about a week. She was treated for a nervous breakdown. They gave her electric shock treatments they thought she was having a nervous breakdown. When she died, I was one. Brother was four. Other brother was five. You know what Dad said? I asked him, well, how long did it take you to get over Mother's death? He says, you know what? You never really get over something like that. He says, you deal with it, but you're never totally free. All right. It's there in your mind. But God gives us peace. He gives us restoration. He gives us reconciliation. Do not let Satan walk in the door and destroy what it is God is building. If we're in the trench, then you stay there. You continue to fight. Maybe relief is not actually going to come, but you endure to the end. Satan's a god of war. God is a god of peace. And that's the peace that he offers for us in the midst of all these things that will descend.